This is Behind the Docs, the show that shines a spotlight on the people shaping how we understand and use technology. In each episode, we pull back the curtain to talk about what it's really like to create the docs we all rely on. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Behind the Docs, the podcast that spotlights the people who make technical content come to life. Whether you're a seasoned tech writer, content strategist, or just curious about the brains behind the docs you rely on every day, the show is for you. Today, we're having a conversation with Fabri Ferri Benedetti. Welcome, Fabri.
Hey, hello there, Patrick. How you doing?
Good. It's really great to have you. You are one of the LinkedIn online personalities that I most enjoy following. So this is like a little bit of a, I don't know, am I starstruck?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure, but it's great having you on the show.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you.
And so today we want to talk about, I guess, the future of TechCom. Like, that's a place that you play a lot right now. And I think play is a really appropriate way of describing it. You spend a lot of time on AI and the tools around it, the overall practice. You post fun things. Like, one of my favorite TechCom memes that I've seen posted in the last several years was, I think it was from Game of Thrones, where he's like pulling his sword out and it has all the different things running
Yeah,
at
that
him.
one. Yeah, the animated GIF. Yeah.
Yeah, so I loved that. And anybody who doesn't know who you are, I strongly encourage them to come follow you. But let's jump in. So, you know, I'd love to start with a little bit of your journey, just kind of, you know, like how you got to where you are now, because I feel like it's evolved quite a bit and it's a very interesting story. And then we can get into the philosophy of where we're going in this next age of AI.
Yeah. Well, I started as a writer in tech, and I think I'm still a writer in tech, just under different, you know, working in different capacities, different job titles, roles, but always in the tech industry. And I started in 2008, writing reviews, software reviews, like for a download portal when software downloads were still a thing, you know, for Windows software. And essentially, that's, you know, that was my introduction, my Yahoo moment, in the sense of like first big tech company, you know, that where you essentially grow up and get your bones and get your experience, learn about SEO, tech stack, lots of things over there, really. I was already a blogger before, like I started blogging in like 2003. So writing and technology had always been there. And after a stint as a content strategist, I landed my first job as a technical writer with that job title. It was in 2016 now. Yes, 2016. So it hasn't been like, it's been a while, like 10 years in the tech writing world. Always with lots of, you know, support from the community. Like Write the Docs has been like key to me. And I spoke there at the conference several times and other venues as well. And the blog, well, I started blogging about technical writing in 2020, actually. And that also has been like very important to me, not just as a way of, you know, like, yeah, of course, it's a personal brand thing, promoting yourself, whatever. I do it because it helps me think. And it helps me gather my thoughts around tech comps. And well, now here I am thinking about AI and tech docs and, you know, whatever will come.
Yeah, that's a great point. I am a huge believer that writing is condensed or organized thinking.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of writing that I don't, you know, put into a blog, although I do have aspirations of someday finding the time to do that. And I can't think in any meaningful way without writing. So one of the things that I'm most concerned about with AI is that we think less because we write less.
Well, there's a bit of that. I think the personal blog really keeps me sane there, because it's writing that you do, you know, off AI, off any sort of tool that might help you, you know, with that, aid you with that. Of course, from time to time, I might ask Claude to come up maybe with some ideas for a title or like a finishing sentence, and then I tweak it. That's okay. Yeah, the risk, I'm still assessing it, to be honest. But I do think there are ways of using AI that don't undermine your abilities, especially the cognitive ones. I think that if you use it, from like, using like a very critical analytical approach, you doubt what you get as an output. You don't go autopilot with it. Chances are that you will use it better and possibly retain your thinking abilities, just maybe at a higher level, more strategic one. But like, for example, I don't really get like I respect people that use AI, like, I'm orchestrators, whatever, spinning hundreds of agents to do things. It's not really my style. I prefer to follow the reasoning of an LLM while it does its thing, and question, and as if I was working with someone. I think that's is a is perhaps the best way, really, to use LLMs while retaining your presence, mentally speaking.
So you found comfort in using an LLM as a collaborator as opposed
Yeah.
to moving yourself to being more of a manager.
Yeah.
I think that makes sense. I've seen that in a lot of the work that I've done with them as well, where it feels good to be directly involved with somebody that can do all the little things that you couldn't type as quickly, but close enough that you're still able to really understand the fundamentals of what's happening. Okay, so before we really dive like too deeply into the philosophy of this, let's finish your journey with where you are now. So you're at Elastic, and you're a principal
Yeah.
technical writer there. But a lot of the philosophy of this is going to come from your current work. So could you describe for our audience a little bit of what you do on a daily basis, what your current work and professional life looks like, how you're contributing to documentation in this new world?
Yeah. So, Elastic, I'm in charge of a chunk of the documentation. We have a very extensive set of documentation that has evolved through the years. One interesting thing is that we build and maintain our own tools for documentation. This was like a tough choice back in the days, but we decided to go that path because we had like some specific requirements. And it's interesting because with the AI, it has sort of become like a field where also non-engineers can contribute to. And I think one of the main things I'm doing right now at my job is helping engineers develop these tools. So we are co-developers. I don't know if I would call myself a documentation engineer. Perhaps at other places that would be the job title. I'm very much into tooling development. And that includes AI tooling. And at the same time, it's not just the tools, it's also the standards, the conventions, the guidelines. There's lots of education and training involved, lots of aligning people. And you probably know this better than anyone, Patrick, that a tool is not enough. You have to explain the mental model. You really have people to align with it and kind of sync with the thinking that goes into the tool, because it's and this is what I'm discovering, especially with custom tools that we build through AI. Custom as in like a tool maybe that I designed just for my own use or for myself, is that the tool is becoming like a reflection of your own thinking. So you are putting your thinking into the tool, as you would maybe put your thinking into your own writing, but now it's becoming something reproducible and operational, and that you can execute as a binary. So that's also like a fun part, not easy to unravel sometimes, but quite interesting.
As you pointed out there, the thing that I consistently see is that organizations and people underestimate the quantity of architecture work
Oh
that's
yeah.
around the tool. And when I use that term, I mean the people and processes and change management and content types and standards and all those kinds of things that an organization has to consider in order to deliver something consistent. It's just perpetually underestimated how much work that actually is.
Yeah,
And
it
you're,
is. And sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and your tooling, it's I guess the, I didn't think I had to finish that thought, but I guess I do have to finish that thought. As you mentioned, your tooling brings some opinion about those things. And you don't even think about that sometimes. So I think a lot of organizations that build their own, they think of the tools just as like literal tools without thinking about the opinions the tools are going to bring to the overall architecture.
And I mean, if you're lucky and not talking about Elastic now or any specific company you know about, but we all know stories where tools sometimes failed to gain traction, even though they were good or considered like very good, because of factors that were extraneous to the tool, like maybe lack of political power within the org. Or sometimes you don't get like this sort of buy-in or virality that some other tools get. So there are many factors that are not related to the technology, that are not related to the quality of the design. So the architecture, of course, is a thing. There's also like all these social aspects around it. And yeah, that's also a thing for sure.
How have you guys come to consider what you're going to put together in that light? Do you feel like you're doing it as you go, or do you step back and plan the architecture, the change management, the culture around the tools as you're building them?
Well, I think it's in our case, I would say it's quite fluid in the sense that the tooling itself is open source. Like if somebody wants to improve it or add something to it, even if it's a bit rare, because of course the tool is quite tailored to our mental model. So it's not like something that the others could easily reuse. They could if they wanted to. But then, it's we get many internal contributions sometimes from users of the tool when other developers or development teams, engineering teams, etc. And we're quite open to it. And it's the same kind of openness that allowed me, for example, to add some features I was missing. Like I recall, like one of my first pull requests was to add like a new directive to render something in the docs. I don't remember right now which one was it. Like maybe it was math formulas or diagrams, whatever. And I just opened the PR, and the maintainers, which are part of the docs engineering team, are so open about it. And I felt like welcomed. And it's that's that to me is like when open source works best is when these things happen. Like when you have such degree of openness and also self-confidence in that in your architecture and how you set up things so that you're sure they can grow well.
Do you feel like the way things are set up at Elastic that the architecture and opinions of the tool set are kind of baked in? Or do you feel like people have to manage what comes in and what changes and what updates are made in such a way that they preserve the core philosophy of the tooling?
Well, there's always like a conversation, like an ongoing conversation. Like not all PRs get merged, not all issues are considered like high priority. The knowledge, the architecture of the tool is kind of a, it's not like written down like a Bible or something. It's more like a group knowledge, and we also develop like a taste over time of the things that might work or might be useful. So perhaps in that sense, it's not super systematic, but it's working for us. So yeah, in that sense, I think we are handling it quite well. But I know for sure that other projects might have difficulties with this model. So.
It's fascinating to me of to think of tooling decisions as kind of a cultural taste. That's a really interesting paradigm.
Yeah.
to evaluate how people put these things together. And I've never thought about it that way. I like that a lot. So I want to shift over to the more philosophical side of things. You're spending a lot of time, I think, both at Elastic and on your blog, Paso Uno. It's Paso.uno or Paso Uno? How am I supposed to say that?
Paso.uno. Yeah,
Okay, I'm supposed to say,
Paso.uno. Yeah.
okay, Paso.uno. I realized as I said that, I was like, wait a second, was I getting that wrong? Anyway, so people who
No, no.
want to go there, it is actually Passo dot UNO, so Paso.uno. So you're spending a lot of time both in your official capacity at
Yeah.
Elastic and in your less official, but extremely valuable and high contribution capacity in the community, thinking about the future of techcom and the future of technical writers. So before we kind of dive into specific topics, I would love for you to just provide a general thought of where you think we're going to be in, call it 18 months, as individuals, as a community, as we're managing our migration from mostly, doing the work ourselves, writing to whatever it is we're going to be doing at that point in time.
18 months. Why 18?
Well,
Like it's
it's kind of the end of 2027, right?
Oh, okay, like
I think in
2027.
quarters. Yeah, I think in quarters, and so it always ends up being next couple of quarters, the next year.
Okay.
So I kind of think in those terms.
I can offer like what I think is, in my opinion, likely scenario or likely prediction of, like from here to 18 months for the profession, for the craft. The first thing I would say is by then, I think most of the hype will have died out of it. And I think we're already seeing some signs of it in the community and especially among the engineers. You might disagree with that. Like lots
No.
of, yeah, go
Can you just say more
ahead.
about what you mean by the hype? I'm so
Hype in
curious to,
this.
yeah.
Yeah, a hype in the sense of, like C levels wanting to onboard everybody, which is fine and totally understandable, but at the same time, we feel like there's like a strong mandate to do so. But also more specifically, I think there's a thing of everybody has to stay on top of things, everybody has to like we there's a big fear of missing out currently, and that's that's continuing, and it's gonna continue for a bit, but I think we are already like plateauing a bit. That's my view there, just based on my feelings of just following almost obsessively community news and AI news. So with that, what will happen is I think we are gonna enter like a stage of reflection and rationalization of the tools we use, how we use them. Like maybe we're gonna cut our usage a bit. We're gonna choose the like the scenarios where we think it makes the most sense to use the models, because what we are also seeing right now is that the economy of AI in tech is becoming like quite expensive. To the point that I saw this tweet the other day that was joking about the cost of junior developers being less than the cost of spending at tokens, a token spent by a senior, and there's some truth to it. There's some truth to it. And lastly, I think we are going to explore more other avenues like more local models, for example. I think the future is in local models. Mostly for most tasks. So we're gonna fine-tune them, we are gonna download them, we're gonna pay attention. Sometimes we're gonna train them from scratch. I mean, big companies will be able to do that. Maybe in 10 years' time also, like consumers will also be able to do that. That's my hope as well, as techniques improve and costs go down, etc. So with local models, I think we'd also feel less bad about using this technology. I know there's very understandable resistance sometimes based on ethical grounds and ecological grounds, and they are very valid concerns. So my hope there is that local models, better techniques, better hardware. We'll also make these technologies more affordable, and we'll be able maybe to execute them like on the phone, like pretty sophisticated stuff. You can already run some models on the phone, but
That's true.
it's still very experimental, you know.
So do you, it's your view that the progress is going to slow down for whatever reason. There's not going to be these massive step function changes in the
I've
capabilities of
not
the
slow
models.
down. I think deepen, like in scope and meaning, and like right now, I think we are most people really most companies are operating in some sort of panic mode. Like
Oh,
we
well,
need to
for
get on
sure.
board. We need to get on board. We need to get onto this train, and that's also what happens with like as this Precambrian explosion of tech that we are having right now. Like, it's a new tech, a completely new stack. Everybody is trying to understand where their place is here. But I think that will inevitably leave room to what I describe as rationalization, or like really trying to go for the things that make sense.
Yeah. There's one specific point in there that I fully agree with you on, which is that I think there's going to be a pretty substantial shift to local models, or at least self-hosted models. I guess the definition of local could be a little different depending on who you ask. I think there will be less broad utilization of the public models. Whether or not things are more rational, that I think
It's a
remains to
bet.
be seen. It's a bet. I hope you're right. I think that the current state of the fervor around AI, we would all be better off if it was a little calmer, maybe general in the industry. So in that world that you see, what do you see the job of, what you have today, a principal technical writer looking like?
So I think it's gonna be an augmented job. That's also like maybe it's there's a bit of wishful thinking there, like in that we are still gonna be around. I'm quite sure of it. It's just not gonna be the same kind of job. I think we are gonna focus less on execution. Execution meaning actual writing, and more on planning, strategizing, taking care of the good data intake, like handling the good context, and then more time also spent in reviewing and validating and rethinking processes. So, in a way, I think it's going to become more like DevOps. Maybe you could call it DocOps, which already kind of exists as a term, in that you're thinking more around content delivery pipelines, channels, and maybe some of these is a bit new to like practitioner of DOCSIS code, because it's, well, they do build docs in CI, but they are not so used maybe thinking around channels. But now they are effectively have a new channel, which is AI. And I think in that, CCMS users are more attuned to it, to the concept of multi-channel publications. So I think that's how I would picture the role, more of a collaborator. Yes, you collaborate with AI, but you execute less, and you handle things, at the top and then at the end. And in the middle, there's the AI working.
I think that shift is inevitable. It depends on, but it's a spectrum, right? So on one end of the spectrum, you're completely an orchestrator. And on the other end of the spectrum, you're completely a hands-on keyboard writer. And I do think that the industry and people in it will definitely move more towards orchestrator. I think that's inevitable. One of the things that we've been playing around with internally here is looking at how much time it takes to write something when you're further on the orchestrator side of the world versus on the writer side of the world. And I worry that there's a section of time after the first deliverable is created that isn't accounted for. Because when you create that first draft deliverable, you gather so much knowledge, you create so many connections to the people who build things, and you become very in tune with what the system is supposed to do, that then the further iterations after that are faster. So we did a study internally on a new feature, and it felt like it's very hard to be precise. It felt like the process of writing it with AI was not really much faster than it was actually just writing it when you encompass the whole process from end to end to getting to a final deliverable. And I wonder how you've experienced that as you've really, really dove into the orchestrator side of things, or at least, your public persona says that
Starting
you
to,
have.
yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a good question about the speed. And interestingly, I think there are two aspects that everybody in the tech writing world is going to pay more attention to due to AI. One is accessibility, just limiting there, just because, I mean, we talked about the channel, we talked about a new kind of reader with special needs, so you have to take care of it. Like maybe you didn't before, but now you have to. And the other is metrics, because now you want to also control costs. You want to understand like how you're using, maybe where you're spending your tokens. Whether those have a return of investment because investments are being substantial everywhere. So the matter of time is very interesting. What I found personally is that there are two types of efforts. One is more foundational, like you start with zero docs. When you start with zero docs, I would never throw the task directly at an LLM because it has nothing to derive thinking from. And LLMs are very good at deriving like words from existing patterns. So foundational work takes a lot of effort and it's mostly human. But then when I think AI really shines is when you scale that and you start automating those bits because you already have like a solid content architecture in place. And this is very, very similar to what happens with software engineering. Like if you laid out the foundation and the architecture of a project, yourself, maybe with a little AI aid, and it's solid, any feature you add afterwards, any expansion you do using AI is going to be more reliable. It's going to require less back and forth, etc. So one thing is content types. The one thing that we are finding extremely useful is content types, and LLMs love them. They love to have like templates, they love to have patterns they can adjust words to. And in the end, what I think this is gonna the return of investment here is that you don't work less, you work more in the things that matter to you and to your customers, and you automate out the bits that take you away from those, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the it's hard to to be sure until you've done quite a bit of it. What is busy work that doesn't add value, and what is busy work that is building understanding or is creating connection or has some other intrinsic value that isn't as immediately obvious? But I think that I agree with you that there's a lot of stuff we don't necessarily need to do. And if you use a classic paradigm, we didn't need to go and adjust the numbering every time we added a new step, right? Like that was bad busy work. Having a system do that for us was a great automation. And there's going to be a lot of that that comes with AI.
Yes,
So if you're.
and the other profile, sorry, back to your previous question about like what a profession looked like, is that we are still gonna have tinkerers, and I include myself. Like there's gonna be people who are gonna spend most of their time around the tools, creating the tools, maintaining the tools and the strategies and the rules around them. So that profile will always be there. And then of course you have the writers who are gonna become like more the orchestrator or creators, but they're gonna put a lot of thinking into the content sets and how you are, distributing the content and the impact of it.
I think that's accurate. So when you think about somebody who's coming into this profession, who's maybe earlier in their career, I feel like the standard advice they all get is like, go play with AI, go learn AI. But like, what does that really mean to somebody who's just getting started in technical communication? Could you give more specific advice maybe to somebody who's trying to make sure they're valuable in the future and they're at the front of their field?
So I would say use AI as a mentor. Use AI as a teacher. Don't go autopilot with with it, because you're not gonna get like a learning experience out of it if you use it that way. You have to be very mindful of any, every query, every question, every answer you get, even the thinking. If you're using a thinking model, you have to pay attention to it. In some cases, like I created ex like an experimental skill the other day, like the teaching mode, where the instructions are, you enable it, and the instructions are, don't give me a solution outright. Try to, like nudge me into solving the problem myself, etc. And sometimes I use this skill to learn like a new piece of technology through AI, but without like all the pre-digested answers or something that would make it like super easy to just copy and paste. So using AI to learn about AI and learn how to use AI, I think, is a solid strategy. It's kind of meta, but it's worked well for me. And then I would say, lots of personal projects and personal experimentation, like creating your own tools, or there's that website that you always wanted to create, maybe for a parent or a friend, and now it's the time. Now you can try that out. See if it works for you, like iterate, you get maybe a feel of the models, how they react. So personal projects are, and that they are quite fun also to do compared to classic documentation portfolio stuff. So
Yeah, that's a good point. So I want to leave with one final question. So in the vein of what we're talking about today, what does great documentation mean to you in this new future?
I think it's great documentation in the future is mostly the same as great documentation right now, except that it has it is more accessible to both humans and machines. That means more metadata, more exposure of this metadata and this information that a machine might find useful. It's also gonna be, I think, maybe a little flatter in the hierarchical sense, to make it like a little easier for a machine to just snaggle the content in just one go. I think there's a bit of that. Like I'm noticing LLMs don't like to dig too deep into like hierarchies and navigations, but that might be just a technical limitation. So not flattering in the sense of tone or quality or anything like that. More like, more accessible, even prepackaged documentation sometimes. And I think it's gonna look more like a book. I think AIs really need to navigate things in a sequence, and sometimes documentation lacks a bit of that.
Interesting.
So I think there's value in presenting things as a coherent set, and as you know, the more coherent, the better. And I think machines also appreciate that.
Oh, I guess everything comes back around, huh?
Yeah, it does. It does. It's the big irony,
Trevor.
really, of AI and documentation is this. It's like we're getting back to the basics because now we have to appease AI, but AI is like just a reflection of what we wanted all along.
I love that. What a great end note to end on. Fabry, it's been fantastic having you here today. I think
Thank
we're going to
you.
do a follow-up because I have a dozen other questions I didn't get to ask you, but this was a lot of fun.
Likewise, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Docs, where the content's structured, but the conversations aren't. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and share it with someone who loves great documentation as much as we do. Until next time, keep creating content that makes a difference.